Cabernet tends to be the sort of Errol Flynn of the grape varieties.
One of Australia's leading beer judges.
People always ask, how do you get involved in sake and how does that connect to music?
Because wine is an adventure.
Conventional winemakers who just condemn all natural wine as faulty.
The prestigious title of Sake Samurai.
Looking at whiskey in more of an artful culinary way.
The difference between getting good quality fresh hops, it just translates straight through into the beer.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine and spirits and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today. The craft spirits movement that has taken hold in recent decades has been followed by a boom in premium mixers. Founded in 2004, UK company Fevertree was undoubtedly the company that started the latter trend. In this episode of the Drinks Adventures podcast, we're joined by Fevertree co-founder and CEO, Tim Warrilow. Tim shares with us the story of Fevertree's journey from startup phase with just a single tonic water to something of a global phenomenon. With Fevertree mixers now sold in over 75 countries globally, the company is listed on the London Stock Exchange with a market cap of £2.46 billion. As regular listeners would know, Fevertree has advertised on this podcast almost since the very beginning, and we're very grateful for their support. Just to be clear, though, this interview with Tim Warrilow isn't sponsored in any way. The episode is part of our usual programming, and it's coming up right after this. What I love about Australian craft spirits is that our distillers are truly free to experiment. We aren't governed by rules and traditions. That's why the flavour and character of Australian spirits is so unique. But it takes distilling prowess and another critical ingredient to bring these products to market, and that ingredient is Bintani. Bintani supplies distillers with malts of all colours, flavours and aromas. They have a leading range of yeast and other ingredients and the professional expertise to help distillers create the spirits of their dreams. Make Bintani your partner in taste and quality. Fevertree was founded in 2004 by drinks industry veteran Charles Rolls together with Tim Warrilow, an entrepreneur with a background in advertising.
Charles had been very successful in turning around the fortunes of Plymouth Gin and had recently sold it to one of the big spirit companies. And the few people we spoke to in the trade when I was doing my research thought that we might get on. So I called Charles up completely out of the blue and we met for a cup of coffee. And over the first cup of coffee, the conversation quickly turned actually from gin to tonic. As, you know, coincidentally, we had both been thinking and looking and researching the tonic category, albeit from different perspectives. But what was apparent is that we clearly shared the same view. And that really, in summary, was that, you know, we were both very aware of the fact that the interest in premium spirits was growing and growing. You know, spirit producers were producing ever better quality spirits. Tax laws were changing, so new and exciting high quality craft spirits were starting to come to the market. And, you know, bartenders, mixologists, as you know, they were known, were talking about spirits and making spirits and cocktails exciting and sexy, you know, almost, you know, as hadn't been seen for, you know, quite some time. So all of this interest and noise, you know, was going on around the world of spirits. Yet in stark contrast, you know, the mixer category had become a long forgotten, you know, really kind of overlooked category dominated by large conglomerate brands and own label products who, you know, had ultimately ended up focusing more on manufacturing efficiency than they had on quality or flavor. And so ingredients such as, you know, artificial sweeteners, such as saccharin, has started to become commonplace and, you know, finding themselves, you know, across the whole category. And, you know, this struck us as extraordinary that here were people prepared to pay ever more money for high quality spirits, but yet had no choice but really to drown them with these increasingly artificial mixers. And so, interestingly, not quite at that first cup of coffee, but not long afterwards, you know, we were saying to each other, you know, if you actually stop and think about it, you know, if 3/4 of that gin and tonic is tonic, you know, surely the quality of the tonic should be as important in people's mind as the quality of the gin. And so really, you know, that was the idea. And we reasoned, we hoped, you know, we believe that, you know, if you could produce a far higher quality product to make that drink taste better, then surely, you know, we could get people interested and to be prepared to pay for it.
Like a lot of the greatest ideas, it seems so obvious when you look back. I mean, why do you think that none of those big major soft drink companies that you mentioned, with all of their innovation teams and all that sort of stuff, why do you think they hadn't done it?
Look, it is a very good question. And you're right, it seems obvious now, but because, you know, excitingly and fortunately, you know, this some premium mixer category has really taken hold. But I tell you, at the time, you know, when we were out, as I mentioned, we met in 2003, but the first product didn't come off the line until 2005. And that's because we spent, for one, an awful lot of time researching and developing the product. But we also spent quite a bit of time, you know, raising some funds and talking to people in the industry. And I think, you know, what was interesting is that everywhere we turned, you know, so-called industry experts, investors, you know, just didn't believe in the opportunity. They thought that, you know, there were a couple of big players who dominated it, and they questioned, you know, whether we could get people's interest. So, you know, I think really that was the circumstance at the time, which now, fortunately, is certainly no longer the case.
Is that about, you know, investment types just not understanding the market?
Well, I think so, but as I, certainly that was our view. But they're also, you know, people in the industry. And so it wasn't just the investment community, you know, who were skeptical. It was people in the industry. And I think this is because not only was it sort of dominated by a couple of big, you know, Goliaths, but actually what is now hard to remember is quite how overlooked and forgotten and how uninterested, you know, the trade were in this category. And I think it was sort of, you know, best summarized, you know, we did one focus group right at the outset of the business. And I'll always remember it because it was dominated by this rather sort of big character, this lady. And she at one point sort of slammed her fist on the desk almost and said, "Look, you don't understand, you know, the mixer category is so boring. You know, what are mixers? What is tonic water? You know, is there anything in it?" I mean, you know, so it had got to this point, you know, that there was so little sort of engagement and interest from consumers, but also the trade. You know, these were, you know, retailers as well. You know, they'd done very little to their sets over the years because there had been so little sort of interest in innovation. So I think, you know, that's the point. It had just fallen out of people's sort of consciousness.
What were the biggest headaches that you faced in getting it off the ground?
Well, I suppose, you know, I look back on it now, is it took us a long time to develop our first product. And, you know, I had given everything up at that point and, you know, had very little funds and savings. So that was quite painful. That was certainly a headache, you know, sort of 18 months or so, you know, before there was any sign of any money coming in. And that is because we went about the way we developed our products, you know, really rather differently from the way the kind of soft drink trade and certainly the mixer trade had done it previously. And that involved spending a lot of time, you know, going back into the history books to go and research mixers, tonic water, particularly at that point. And then actually rather uniquely, you know, having decided what we needed to do was we needed to go and find the best quality ingredients, the most authentic and the best quality. You know, that was going to be the route that we were pursuing. And, you know, not only having some research, then we wanted actually to go out and find them, go and meet the producers, talk to the producers, you know, go and understand them and go and understand, you know, what makes something better and worse as an ingredient. So that then sparked, you know, an enormous amount of time traveling around, you know, going to find ingredients. And I have to say, it still does. I mean, it's one of the great sort of joys of the job now. But that, as a result, meant our product development time was much longer than was typical. And so that was certainly a challenge. But, you know, I'm glad we took that route because it has really paid off.
Now, that first product, I believe, was the Indian tonic. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right, exactly.
And what was sort of the moment when you felt like you were starting to get some traction?
We launched, as I say, back in 2005, and then it was a typical spirits launch, if you like. You know, this was the other way that we approached it, very differently from soft drinks. You know, we took much more of a spirits approach, deciding that we really wanted to focus on the hotel bar restaurant trade. We really wanted to get those opinion formers on board, you know, the bartending community, the chefs. And so, you know, it was a case of, you know, going around, you know, door to door, getting that crowd to do the taste test to see the difference in terms of the product quality. You know, once they tasted the difference and, you know, we told them our tale of the ingredients that were in it and the lengths we'd gone to, you know, it started to capture their imagination. And it provoked a very small amount of column inches here in London, which very fortuitously was read by the buyer of Waitrose. Waitrose is our sort of premium supermarket chain here. And very unexpectedly, she called us up out of the blue, having read this one very small article. And that was, you know, very fortuitous. I've just since learned how fortunate that was, because how rare it is for retail buyers to actually call you. But she was saying that actually we've been waiting for a product like this. And so she got it on her supermarket shelves. And they're, you know, they launch so many products, you know, they have a pretty good idea of when something's going to work or not. And so they also had this policy at the time in Waitrose where you couldn't promote or market a new product on shelf. It had to sit there and sell off its own accord. So it had a lonely 6 weeks on shelf with no sort of marketing support around it. But it started to sell. And she said she'd seen enough to give us full distribution. So I suppose at that point, you know, we started to get some confidence that it wasn't just us that believed there was an opportunity. You know, the consumers were seeming to react to it.
There must have been a point fairly early on where you attracted the attention of the majors and they came to try and seduce you to take Fever-Tree under their wing.
Well, I mean, the truth is that we haven't been interested. I mean, there's certainly been some interest over time, but, you know, as I still feel to this day, is that, you know, we're still just getting started. The opportunity that is sort of unfolding ahead of us in this category is as exciting now as it's always been. So, you know, that really has been our focus, you know, to grow the business ourselves. Rather than look towards someone else.
Looking at the portfolio now, it's expanded to, I think you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but 8 different tonics that I can see. Is there a risk of the portfolio becoming too complex? How do you sort of manage having that many different tonics without confusing the consumer?
Well, look, I mean, that was all part of the plan at the beginning, as I described the kind of lack of interest in the category. So we thought, right, okay, you know, how we're going to create interest is not only go and produce the very best quality product we can, but also, you know, one of our realizations at the outset was the fact that, you know, there was so little kind of interest and engagement. And, you know, as in that, from that market research we did, is someone said, you sleepwalk your way down the mixer aisle because there's so little to engage you. Whereas, you know, you turn a corner and you're suddenly in the chocolate aisle, coffee aisle, the spirits aisle, and there's all sorts of choice and varieties and flavors. So what we wanted to do was start to put, you know, choice and interest and flavor, you know, back in. We went to develop different styles of tonics that went with the different styles of gins that were starting to come to the market. So, you know, a more floral tonic to go with more a floral gin, etc. So that is how we have developed our range. And actually, it has proved to be a great way of getting people interested in not just tonic water, but gin and tonic, you know, because off the back of it, we have developed gin and tonic menus across the hotel, bar, restaurant trade. You know, this was sort of unforeseen before we got going. And so, you know, it has created this whole sort of drink movement by bringing this choice back into mixes as well as into gin.
It took you quite a long time to launch a Fever Tree Cola, which, considering, you know, how big cola is globally, is kind of surprising. Why did that take so long?
Well, because primarily it's because we've got a lot to do in terms of growing our existing range, which is where I have to say we are still most focused. And that existing range, is, as you point out, is our tonics, focused very much on sort of gin and tonic, and also our gingers, which are ginger ale and ginger beer. And that is where the majority of our focus is. But we developed a cola because there was a lot of request for it from the trade. And, you know, they were saying the same thing to us. Look, you know, can't you do for cola what you've done for tonic and ginger, i.e. by putting, you know, fantastic ingredients in and also directing, you know, this product more at the sort of adult audience. And so that was the rationale behind developing our cola. But, you know, we're building our plans on that front to start to roll this out more widely. And so, you know, that's just what we're looking at the moment.
Packaging in the small glass bottles has been, you know, a key element of the Fever Tree brand proposition. And you can maybe explain why that is. But obviously there are some challenges with that and concerns from an environmental perspective. Have you looked at innovating with some new solution with bulk formats for the on-trade at all?
Well, look, I mean, we put it in glass very specifically because the trade was and still is awash with large plastic bottles. And glass remains, you know, the best container to retain freshness, carbonation and fizz. And also, of course, it has an elevation to it in terms of look relative to big PET or plastic bottles. But we've always, right from the start, made sure that we've used as much recyclable glass as the industry will allow. And it remains, you know, just about the most recyclable format around the world. So, you know, for all of those reasons, I think it is a fantastic package. But we also have cans, which are growing and growing. And also, of course, you know, highly recyclable. So, you know, that's our focus. But in terms of bulk, you know, the problem is carbonation. And, you know, the old soda gun, its great flaw is the fact it produces, you know, poorly carbonated product. And there is nothing that kills a great gin and tonic more than flat tonic. Carbonation is king, you know, when it comes to tonic water. So, you know, as a result, it is a more inferior way of delivering, you know, a great gin and tonic.
What was involved with finding those ingredients to get started with your first products?
Yeah. Well, as I say, you know, we went into the library to go and, you know, research the most authentic, best ingredients, and then actually went out in the field to go and find them. And, you know, this has involved, you know, travels all around the world. And it's taken us to some, you know, pretty wonderful and interesting and memorable places. I mean, last year or so, I was out in the Yucatan province where we find this sort of rare lime that we've put into quite a number of our products, taking us to places, you know, beautiful places like Sicily, where we've sourced this sort of wonderful lemon extract, but also some pretty dangerous places. And in my case, the most memorable of which was my trip out to go and source quinine. So quinine is the very essence of tonic water. And my research showed that the last remaining plantation of the highest quality quinine was unfortunately in just about the most remote and lawless place, which was in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. And just to get there, I had to fly from London to Nairobi in Kenya, from Nairobi to Kigali in Rwanda, and then persuade a local taxi driver to drive me the 8 hours across Rwanda just to get to the border. And then I realized quickly how lawless it was, because just in those few miles it took to go from that border to the gates of the plantations, I got stopped with this local taxi driver three times with three different sort of forms of armed roadblocks. The first was someone who threw this plank of wood, which these 6-inch nails out in front of the taxi, which is a very effective way of getting you to stop. The second one, he didn't even go to the lengths of producing a bit of wood and nails. He just had a bit of string across the road, but he was so well armed that he stopped anyway. And the third one is the image that has remained with me ever since, which is just a sort of young kid, teenager, who had a rocket launcher slung over his shoulder. And again, that was also a very good way of getting you to stop. So, I mean, you know, that is tragically sort of how lawless this part of the world is. But what it is the most fertile place almost in the world. To this day, we still source all our quinine from them. And actually, I went there not all that long ago, the end of last year, and it was great to see, you know, in this area, as our business has grown, that they've grown with us and the work and employment it's bringing to the area as well. So it's been heartening, that relationship, and I have enormous respect for those people running that plantation in those conditions.
Sure. Now, obviously, gin is, you know, the king of spirits at the moment in terms of growth, but I'm imagining you at Fevertree are really watching very carefully what's happening in some emerging categories. Are there any other categories of spirits that you're excited about at the moment in terms of the growth prospects?
Internationally, yes. You know, there are lots of categories that are of interest to us. I mean, you know, as a business, you know, what we're so excited about is, you know, whilst the business has grown, you know, very well and very quickly over these last 15 years or so, I mean, still our business in large part is being focused on gin. But, you know, when you stop and think about it from a global perspective, gin only accounts for about 6% of global spirits sales. Whereas if you take dark spirits, for instance, you know, it's 10 times that size, the category. And so that is why we have been developing over the last few years our range of mixes specifically to go with dark spirits. And when I say dark spirits, I'm talking, of course, about whiskies and rums. And so we've been developing our range of ginger ales and also ginger beers. But again, in just the same way we did with our tonic waters, we've been developing them with ingredients that are specifically developed and designed to help complement and enhance those dark spirits that they're mixed with. So, you know, we're working very hard with the bourbon producers in America, which is a category, you know, which is growing very, very strongly in many places around the world. I know Australia as well. And also the Irish whiskey producers and, of course, the Scotch whiskey producers. So, you know, there's that whole world of whiskey that is growing and growing that we're working with. So we're very excited about that. But then also in North America, our business with tequila is growing very quickly. You know, we've got a couple of wonderful products to mix with tequila. And actually, a recent launch of ours is a pink grapefruit, which makes this perfect Paloma drink. And that's growing, you know, very quickly for us. And that's not to mention the vermouths and obviously vodka and all these other categories that we're also sort of working hard with.
I know that, you know, Fevertree has sort of always outsourced its production. Has there ever been a point where you've considered building a soft drink production plant?
There hasn't been, for the simple reason that this model is working very well for us. And indeed, it seems to be working well for our production partners. So, you know, the whole point of it was that we wanted to set up a business that allowed us agility, allowed us to focus on the things that we really wanted to focus on, which is, you know, developing of the products and leave the expertise of production to other people. But also it meant that we could scale quickly and we wouldn't be hindered by the management of our own production plants. So it's really worked well for us. And as I say, also for our production partners, who feel very much like they're part of the Fevertree business, I have to say. And it's a model, I think, that will stand the test of time.
Obviously, Fevertree has really had the first mover advantage in this category. But since, you know, you launched in 2005, obviously the bigger companies have reacted one way or another. And then there's been a lot of challenger brands. I don't know how many new premium mixer brands there are in the UK, but are you seeing those as a threat at all? Have any of them taken a dent out of your market share?
Well, look, I mean, at the last count, we counted over 100 sort of, I have to say, we describe them as Me Too or copycat brands that have come into this premium mixer category. So there have been no shortage of people. And those are, you know, from the biggest companies to the smallest companies, you know, all who have been, you know, having a go at the category. And, you know, in principle, of course, you know, having more people engaged in the category is a positive thing because it creates interest and engagement on a wider scale. But, you know, selfishly, I'm pleased to say that they haven't taken out much of a dent of our share. I mean, I sit here in the UK and, you know, this is where the competition has been most intense. But, you know, we currently have, you know, well over 35% or so of the category, and all those other premiums together account for 2 or 3%. So, you know, fortunately, we're still staying well ahead of them.
Are there a lot of barriers to entry to get into this category?
There are more than you might think, and particularly if you're going to do it well and properly. And of course, you know, the ultimate barrier to entry is to make sure you're producing a great product, which, as I've described in our case, you know, took us 18 months to develop. But then, you know, the bigger barrier, of course, is finding people who will produce the product for you, and then ultimately getting a consumer who is interested in your product, which takes time. I mean, you know, whilst we've been growing quickly, we've now been going for 15 or 16 years and, you know, been developing that relationship with our customers as we've gone. And I think some people always think you can dive in and sort of create that quickly overnight, and that's proved not to be the case.
You've launched a new range of premium flavoured sodas, and I think you mentioned that a bit earlier on. What's the fundamental difference between a mixer and a soda?
Well, I mean, there isn't. You know, we describe the sodas as part of our sort of mixer family. But, you know, in this case, you know, a soda, which, you know, historically has been a mixer that has been mixed with whiskey and vodka, has, you know, the salty, the bicarbonate of soda in it, you know, which gives it that slight saltiness. And so that's what, if you like, in terms of an ingredient, differentiates it from a tonic, which has got sort of quinine in for the bitterness. Soda's got this bicarbonate in. But we have developed, again, these different flavoured sodas specifically to go with vodka and Italian vermouths. So we've developed this wonderful kind of Mexican lime and yuzu soda to go with vodka, and this Italian blood orange soda to go and suit this wonderful spritz movement that is growing around the world. And we launched them 3 or 4 months ago in the UK. And, you know, sadly, we were hoping to launch some great fanfare across the hotel bar restaurant business, but because of COVID, that was closed. And so, you know, they went on the supermarket shelves. And fantastic and amazing, really, is that, you know, people have found them out, and that they are growing very quickly for us. And, you know, we're getting some great reports and reviews on them. So it's an exciting next leg for us to keep developing.
I saw in your trading update from April that you said that sales in bars and restaurants, which make up 45% of the business, had been severely affected by COVID, obviously. So has that gap closed at all with the rise of the at-home drinking occasion?
Yes, it really has. I mean, of course, you know, COVID has thrown up all sorts of difficulties and challenges, none more so than, as you say, you know, sadly, our friends in the hotel bar restaurant industry being closed or severely impacted. But I have to say, you know, despite that, and despite the fact that historically that has accounted for, you know, nearly half of our business, our business has performed better than we could have expected. And that is because, as you say, people have been, you know, turning to gin and tonics and other mixed drinks at home in greater numbers around the world than ever before. You know, I think it's proved a much needed affordable treat. You know, we've had some wonderful comments from people from all over the place, you know, talking about, you know, thank you, Fevertree. You've got sort of no idea. You know, the only thing that's kept me going through homeschooling my children is the thought of that gin and tonic, you know, at the end of the day. And indeed, you know, we've heard the same thing from people, you know, working from home, saying, you know, it's been the perfect thing to look forward to, is making and mixing a good drink. And I think that really has caught people's interest and imagination. You know, someone said it's right up there with the interest in home baking, you know, starting to, you know, make good drinks at home. And so, you know, I think as a result, the industry, I'm not just speaking for us, but the spirits industry as well, is pretty optimistic that this is a trend, you know, that will only continue.
Tim, I better let you go. Thanks so much for joining us on the Drinks Adventures podcast.
Well, James, thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure, and I'm sorry to have to head off.
The Drinks Adventures podcast is produced by me, James Atkinson, with additional production and mixing by Dave Robertson. You can find complete transcripts, links, and other information on the show at drinksadventures.com.au. You can follow me on all social media platforms at By James Atkinson. Like my Facebook page, James Atkinson Drinks Adventures, to be kept informed of podcast giveaways and other news about the show. The Drinks Adventures podcast needs your support as listeners. Please do us a favour and leave an honest review and rating for the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. We love hearing your feedback, and it helps inform other people this is a show worth listening to. Or simply drop us a line at hello@drinksadventures.com.au.